Welcome to Tuesday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, filling in for Melody, who's spending the late afternoon working away in the office. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Or look us up on the web at dgscoins.com. That's dgscoins.com. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Today is Tuesday, April 6, 2021. And thanks in advance to our producer and engineer, Todd. Let's get started with today's market report. Good day with precious metals. Gold was up $14.50, a little shy of 1%, to $17.44 an ounce, even as expectations for a robust global economic recovery continue to, be reported. Today, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, raised its global growth forecast and now sees global economies on average expanding 6% this year, and another 4.4% in 2022. That's up compared to the October growth forecast of 5.2 and 4.2% respectively. And over the medium term, the IMF expects global growth to settle around 3.3%. Now, silver also up 30 cents, 1.2% at $25.24. Platinum up 2.5%, 29 bucks at $12.43. And palladium also up about a percent, 25 bucks at $2,750. Now, sticking with the commodities for a moment, oil. Crude oil was up a percent plus, about 71 cents a barrel, closing at $59.36 a barrel. Now, it's no surprise here, given the strong stock market trading again near record highs in three of the U.S. indexes, that all the Treasury yields fell today. The 10-year fell almost 7 basis points to close at 1.65%. The 2-year was down 1 basis point to 0.16. And the 30-year long-term note down about 5 basis points at 2.31%. Now, that came on the heels of a slipping dollar, again, with those falling yields. The U.S. dollar index down 0.3, about a third of a percent, at 92.3. And in the good old-fashioned equity markets, that's do one more refresh here. All three of the U.S. markets down. It was a mixed bag in the international markets overnight and earlier today. It looks like the Hong Kong index was up 2%. That was the biggest gain. It looks like the Nikkei was the biggest decliner at 1.3%. But the Dow Jones down 97. Close at 33,430. The broader S&P 500 down about 4, close at 4,074. And the NASDAQ down 7 points, close at 13,698. Take a quick look. I don't think there's anything else to report today. So that will do it for today's DGS Coins Market Report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, news Again, positive, a lot of positive news out there today. As always, it's a mixed bag, but the March reading of the ISM Services Index reached the highest level on record, reported today, with data going back to 1997, far outpacing economists' forecasts. At 63.7, it jumped more than 8 points from February. Now, readings from business owners in the U.S. services sectors now have joined the manufacturing sector in, well, call it what it is, ebullience about the future. As stimulus checks hit bank accounts, vaccination rates on the rise, and hints of job growth returning quickly. Business activity rose 14 points to a record high in March as well. New orders rose 15 points and employment increased 4.5. And of course, business owners noted that the prices they paid for goods were rising as well, with the index for prices climbing to its highest level since 2008. That's a long-running theme of sentiment indexes so far this year. Now, Tony Neves, who chairs ISM Services Business Survey Committee, said respondents' comments indicate that the lifting of COVID pandemic-related restrictions has released pent-up demand for many of their respective company services. Production capacity constraints, material shortages, weather, and challenges in logistics, as well as human resources, continue to cause supply chain disruption. Analysts at Jefferies noted that their economic activity index for the U.S. rose last week to the highest level since last March, just before the pandemic was officially declared. Since bottoming on January 15th, the index is up over 14 points, according to Jefferies. One of their economists, Tom Simons, says consumer activity accounts for half of that increase, consistent with the lift from fiscal stimulus and the reopening. Our employment and movement composites have also increased meaningfully, as confirmed by March payrolls. Now, the recovery may not be such a good sign for stock prices, however. One too-big-to-fail bank analyst, Binky Chadha, says that equities have historically traded closely with indicators of cyclical macro growth, such as the ICMs, with a correlation of 73% positive. Growth typically peaks around a year, 10 to 11 months, after a recession ends. The S&P sold off around growth peaks by a median negative 8.4. But even episodes which saw the ISM flatten out rather than fall saw a median 5.9% sell-off. So certainly the U.S. stock market's reacting in good part to that particular report. Interesting, we've been following retail for the last couple of years as the retail apocalypse has begun unfolding and certainly continues to this day, although the characteristics of it in terms of in-person buying versus online purchases has changed drastically. Consumers across the globe spent $900 billion more at online retailers last year compared with the prior period. That's according to a report released today by MasterCard Economics Institute. Shoppers are heading back to restaurants and returning to stores to buy clothes and shoes in person. Yet, they appear to continue to stock their fridges and hunt for good deals online. It's a sticky habit developed during the pandemic. And now nearly every retailer's online sales jumped as shoppers were stuck at home during a good part of the past year, as consumers picked up online purchases in the parking lot and got packages or takeout dropped at their doors. E-commerce made up about $1 out of every $5 spent on retail around the world. That's an increase from about one out of every $7 spent the year before. MasterCard chief economist Bricklin Dwyer said about 20 to 30% of that $900 billion in additional digital spending will continue this year and over the next few years. However, he added the long-term e-commerce gains will be uneven and will depend on what a retailer sells, how they've adapted their business model, and what consumers prefer to shop for. For some merchandise, such as clothing, shoppers may prefer to go back to brick-and-mortar stores where they can try an outfit on before buying it. I know that with my COVID 20 pounds, count me in among that group. I need to walk, and walking to stores or in a mall on occasion, not as fun as my long walks with my two grandsons, but a consolation that I can look forward to. And certain retail categories like electronics, online purchases already drove a larger share of overall sales, so there was less room to grow. Grocery and discount stores will see the most dramatic and lasting shift to e-commerce. Discount stores include the dollar stores, the wholesale clubs, and other retailers that sell to customers at near wholesale prices. Grocers will likely retain about 70 to 80% of the digital sale gains they saw during the peak of the pandemic, while discount stores will see about 40 to 50% of them stick around. Now, in a related story, and this goes to the heart of the retail apocalypse, although the pace of store closures has slowed from its 2019 peak, don't expect the reprieve to last too long. That's according to a new report that suggests America still has far too much retail space per capita. According to a new study from the Too Big to Fail UBS, at the end of last year, there were 115,000 shopping centers across the U.S. That's compared to 112,000 in 2010 and 90,000 in 2000. That equates to about 59 square feet of shopping center space per U.S. household, which is slightly less than 62 square feet in 2010, but still well above the 55 square feet of space per household in 2000 and 49 square feet in 1990. UBS is estimating that about 80,000 retail stores, which is 9% of all stores in the U.S., will shut across the country in another 5 years, that is, by the end of 2026. And that assumes e-commerce sales, that's the beginning of 2026. That assumes that the e-commerce sales rise to represent 27% of total retail sales by then. That's up from 18% today. Now, even though more Americans are increasingly ordering everything from milk and bread to desks and chairs to sneakers on the internet, as we just mentioned, store openings are outpacing closures for the first time in years. That's real surprising. Many businesses are seizing the moment to take advantage of cheaper rent and ample vacant space to pick from. The growth largely stems from retailers that sell in beauty, grocery, and discount goods, which are anticipating a strong post-pandemic rebound in visits to stores. U.S. retailers have already announced almost 3,200 store closures against 3,500 store openings this year, according to CoreSite Research. The firm tracked 9,800 closures in 2019, the highest it's been since CoreSite started following this data. That figure fell to about 8,700 last year. Now, Too Big to Fail, Credit Suisse Bank yesterday announced several high-level staff departures, i.e. firings, and a proposed cut to its dividend as it weighs heavy losses from the recent Archegos Capital fiasco. Swiss lender now expects a first quarter pre-tax loss of around 900 million Swiss francs. It's about $960 million after taking a charge of 4.4 billion Swiss francs as a result of the scandal. The bank said that investment bank CEO Brian Chin and Chief Risk and Compliance Officer Lara Warner will step down from their roles with immediate effect. Last week, Credit Suisse revealed that it was expecting heavy losses in the wake of the meltdown at Archegos. The bank was forced to dump a significant amount of stock, much of it tied up in derivatives, to sever its ties to the troubled hedge fund. The executive board also waived its bonuses for the 2020 financial year, with board chair Urs Rohner giving up his, quote, chair fee of 1.5 million Swiss francs. At a shareholder meeting on April 30th, Credit Suisse is expected to propose a smaller dividend of 10.10 Swiss francs gross per share, along with the amended compensation report. It's suspended its share buyback program and said it doesn't intend to resume it until it's regained its targeted capital ratios and has restored its dividend. Last month, the bank announced a shakeup of its asset management business and a suspension of bonuses to that staff as it looked to contain the damage from the collapse of British supply chain finance firm Greensill Capital. Credit Suisse board has launched two separate investigations to be carried out by third parties into both the Greensill and Archegos sagas. Brett Beat Whitman, partner at Zurich-based Porta Advisors, said that while the Credit Suisse case doesn't represent a systemic crisis, in his opinion, there could be more casualties, in his words, unless the root causes are addressed in the banking sector. Well, we'll talk about more. We'll talk more about this probably when we get back from the break. But in the meantime, Whitman observed that the danger is always that we just focus on changing people, but stick with the same business models, as well as the same incentives, exploiting the same regulatory loopholes. And that does no one any good, not the bank, not its shareholders, not its employees, certainly not its customers, and in some cases, it doesn't help the taxpayers of the countries that they're located in. Whitman also argued that European investment banks had not adapted to the safeguards in the same way as their American counterparts have in the wake of the Great Recession. We'll stop there. Hear that music. Stick around. Come back after this break. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TruthAndEducationRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. I'm Dave Allen. Right before the break, we were talking about Credit Suisse and some of the impacts of its misadventures in the Archegos capital fiasco. I noted particularly it stands out this guy at Porta Advisors in Switzerland, Beat Whitman, who says the Credit Suisse case doesn't represent a systemic crisis. Well, I respectfully beg to differ, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, he also noted that European investment banks have not adapted to the safeguards post 2008 in the same way as their American counterparts have. Well, I'm not so sure that the American counterparts have. I mean, they certainly don't appear to have learned their lessons, and now with Archegos, we're seeing a lot of what I call frightening numbers. I mean, late last month, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency here in the States released its quarterly report on bank trading and derivatives activities. A particular note, it showed that J.P. Morgan Chase's federally insured bank had exposure to $2.65 trillion in face value of stock derivatives as of the end of last year. $2.65 trillion. Now, I agree with our friends at Wall Street on Parade that that's a stunning figure for the largest federally insured bank in the U.S. to have that kind of exposure in the stock market. Even more striking is that, according to the OCC, J.P. Morgan Chase's equity derivatives contracts represent almost two-thirds of the $4.2 trillion in total equity derivative contracts held at the end of last year by all federally insured banks in the U.S. In other words, there were 5,033 federally insured banks and savings associations across the country as of September 30th. That's according to the FDIC. But just one of them, J.P. Morgan Chase, accounts for 63% of all equity derivatives, making the situation even more eye-popping. Of the $2.65 trillion that J.P. Morgan Chase holds in these contracts, 72% of them are private bilateral contracts known as over-the-counter contracts. This means that federal regulators likely have little to no knowledge of the terms of those contracts, who the counterparties are to J.P. Morgan Chase, if those counterparties have also obtained leverage under similar contracts at other Wall Street banks, and is at risk of blowing up the whole, you know, all of Wall Street, if it should implode, just like Citigroup, AIG, and Lehman Brothers did in 2008. Now, as to just how effectively the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation of 2010 actually reined in risk on Wall Street, well, listen to this. I mean, this following statistic offers, I think, insight. According to the OCC, at the height of the financial crisis in the fourth quarter of 2008, stock derivative contracts held by federally insured banks totaled $2.2 trillion. What did I say they were today? $4.2 trillion, an increase of 91%. Lessons learned, ladies and gentlemen? I don't think so. And Pam and Russ Martins, who run Wall Street on Parade, believe this raises the serious question of whether the congressional oversight committees, the Senate Banking and the House Financial Services Committees, should be investigating the monetization of the stock market via Wall Street's ownership of federally insured deposits. Again, it gives rise to the question of whether Congress should bring back the Glass-Steagall Act that required the separation of the deposit-taking parts of the bank with its investment bank sisters. Now, given J.P. Morgan Chase's 5 felony counts over the past 7 years for its criminal risk appetite, it leaves you wondering if the bank's not having disclosed its Archegos exposure because it's gotten better at managing risk and didn't have any, or simply better at managing the media and is just avoiding reporting. One notable fact stands out that Melody and I mentioned on a recent financial survival program. According to J.P. Morgan Chase's 13F filing with the SEC for the period ending December 31 of 2020, the bank held about 24 million shares of Discovery common stock. And that's one of the key stock positions that collapsed, I think, by 50% price in late March and helped to bring down the Archegos hedge fund. According to press reports, Archegos likely owned exposure to Discovery via a stock derivatives contract with a major Wall Street bank. The plot thickens, ladies and gentlemen. Stay tuned. We'll tell you more as we learn it. Thank you again to Pam and Russ Martins. Now, with the pandemic bearing down in the U.S. and Congress negotiating with the Trump administration over a relief bill, this all last year, Uber begged Trump not to leave out its drivers, who would normally not be eligible for unemployment benefits because they're not regular payrolled employees. Congress soon created a whole new unemployment system that covered independent contractors and so-called gig workers as part of the CARES Act last March. The pandemic unemployment assistance program has paid out since then more than $100 billion in claims to millions of workers who would never have received benefits without it. One person who drove for Uber and Lyft until last March said it was pretty much a lifesaver. If that CARES Act wasn't passed, I have no idea where I would be. The PUA program provides essentially the same benefits as regular unemployment compensation, but with expanded eligibility criteria that include both gig workers and people like pregnant women who shouldn't work because of the risk of virus exposure. The expansion resulted in a much higher percentage of jobless workers receiving jobless benefits and amounted to a huge favor for gig companies like Uber and Lyft. Businesses like those have long avoided the traditional expense of being an employer and imposed them on workers and the public, along with avoiding unemployment insurance taxes by classifying its drivers as independent contractors. Those companies skip out on Social Security taxes and workers' compensation fees while avoiding basic labor laws like minimum wage and overtime. The drivers provide their own cars and cover wear and tear. Congress has twice extended the PUA program now, but it expires again in early September when the pandemic will hopefully be waning thanks to mass vaccination. The unemployment rate will be falling, and some lawmakers will be likely losing their appetite for additional emergency legislation. But the expiration could force a national reckoning with gig companies that stranded their workers in a plague in the first place. Andrew Stettner of the Century Foundation said they've kind of gotten off scot-free, and they haven't made any contributions to this program whatsoever. The simplest option for Congress would be to extend PUA for another few months or just to let it expire, reverting to the pre-pandemic status quo. Some states and courts have tried to crack down on gig companies and force them to reclassify workers as employees, which would require them to swallow new costs, essentially upend their business models. After California legislators did just that by passing the law known as AB 5 in 2019, the companies managed to carve themselves out of the law a year later when voters, California voters, approved Prop 22. Vina Dubal, who's a law professor at University of California's Hastings Law School, said companies like Uber should be paying unemployment insurance taxes and that a special system should not be set up expressly for the app-based companies. Instead, she argued, their workers should be properly classified as employees for all basic protections. Don't see that happening anytime soon, but you never know. U.S. Department of Labor may have a different look over the next 4 years. Sticking along pandemic relief, as of April 1st, that is just last week, millions of recently unemployed Americans can now opt to have the federal government cover their health insurance costs for several months. And that's offering much needed relief to people struggling financially during this time. The federal government will start paying the full premiums for Americans who are getting their health insurance through the program, federal program known as COBRA, C-O-B-R-A. That's been in existence for a couple of decades now, Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act. That's a federal program that allows the jobless to continue being covered through their former employee's health insurance plan for at least 18 months, but at their own personal cost. The benefits, one of several health care provisions in the American Rescue Plan, that's the $1.9 trillion relief package that Congress passed mid last month. The federal government will foot the bill for 6 months, that is through the end of September. There's no definite estimate for how many Americans this program will reach, but it's expected to be in the millions, if not more. As of last August, an estimated 12.7 million Americans had lost their health insurance during the pandemic. That's according to the Economic Policy Institute. But half that number was spouses and children who were getting health insurance through their partners and parents' employers. If you don't know, for most Americans, COBRA is prohibitively expensive. On average, employer-sponsored private health insurance was $7,470 for single coverage and $21,300 for family coverage in 2020. That's according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. And that comes out to $622 and $1,778 per month, respectively, a steep cost indeed for someone who has just lost a job. Now, to be eligible for this new benefit, Americans must qualify for COBRA either because they lost their job or saw a reduction in hours. But they can't be eligible for Medicare or another health care plan either through their spouse or a new employer. The plan also allows those who previously declined COBRA but have otherwise been eligible to benefit. The American Rescue Plan requires health insurance companies is to notify all eligible Americans about these benefits. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that a previous version of this benefit proposed earlier last year would reach an additional 2.2 million Americans, 600,000 of whom would have been uninsured without this new provision. Certainly not a perfect fix, and it's only temporary. Although congressional progressives have derided what they're calling a Band-Aid as being a boon for private insurers that have already reported big profits during the pandemic. After all, they say, the government's essentially paying for Americans to stay on private plans instead of moving them on to cheaper public ones, such as Medicare and Medicaid. And six states, they add, Alabama, Alaska, Idaho, Indiana, Michigan and Montana haven't expanded COBRA to apply to businesses that employ fewer than 20 people. Well, in any event, at least for the next 6 months, this will give many, in fact, many millions, some peace of mind while they're out of a job. Now, Booking.com CEO Glenn Fogel says the share of business travel will be forever lower than it was during before the pandemic. Business travel, as we know, is an outsized impact on parts of the travel and leisure industry, which is in the midst of adapting to post-pandemic demand and has been among the hardest hit industries during this period. For example, only about 12% of air travel comes from business passengers, but they represent 75% of an airline's profits. Booking.com introduced a new $50 credit for future travel as an incentive to help drive demand for leisure trips. That's a segment that's expected to pick up faster than business travel. The CDC issued new guidelines on Friday for U.S. domestic travel as the number of people who've been fully vaccinated climbed to roughly 20%. Axios transportation correspondent Joanne Mueller says there are unmistakable signs of pent-up demand for leisure travelers. But business travel, she adds, is likely going to take much longer to recover, in part because companies are still trying to figure out what return to work looks like. It's going to be easy to replace some corporate travel with virtual Zoom meetings, but when it comes to things like sales, where competition's intense, and it's important to read the room, so to speak, travel is likely to become a necessity once more. Now, just in the minute we have before the next break, another sign of the coming apocalypse, the cryptocurrency market capitalization hit an all-time peak of $2 trillion yesterday. The new record comes as gains over the last several months attracted demand from both institutional and retail investors. And by mid-afternoon, the crypto market was at $2.02 trillion. The surge, of course, was led by Bitcoin, which hit its own milestone by holding at a $1 trillion dollar market cap for 1 week. Bitcoin was last up at $59,045 per coin. And since hitting a lifetime peak of more than $61,000 in mid-March, Bitcoin's been trading in a relatively narrow range. Analysts are saying as long as Bitcoin stays above $53,000, it'll be able to maintain that $1 trillion market cap. I don't get it, but it is what it is, ladies and gentlemen, and so is this break. Stick around for your few important messages. We'll be right back. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TimUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Before we jump into our weekly newsletter, just want to talk about Afghanistan for a moment. There's less than a month until the deadline for withdrawing U.S. troops from that country that was imposed by Donald Trump. And now President Biden faces one of the most intense lobbying campaigns of his two-month-old presidency. Biden's already said he won't meet the deadline, but in closed-door meetings, parties on all sides, former troops, lawmakers, generals, and Afghans themselves are reportedly trying to shape his final decision on whether to bring the forces home or to extend their deployment. And while similar groups have been lobbying for years, as Trump and Barack Obama promised and then failed to pull the U.S. out, the influence game is different this time, and an end to America's longest-running foreign intervention reportedly is more likely. The observers are saying that's due to a mix of factors. They include the new power of anti-war activists, particularly within the Democratic Party, and then there's Biden's longstanding awareness of ambitious American plans for Afghanistan. Many advocates make their case in powerful personal terms. On March 9th, former Army intelligence analyst S.D. LaMonica attended a private meeting that included Armed Services Committee Chair Jack Reed, who's known as one of the most influential, at least Democrats, working on national security these days. To LaMonica, who struggles with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, it's clear that closure for the tens of thousands of troops who've been stationed in Afghanistan since 2001 depends on a withdrawal. He said, most of us haven't dealt with it. And one partial reason for that is that we're still there. For a lot of us, it would help knowing there's not other people suffering. Well, last week, lawmakers in Afghanistan met virtually with some of their counterparts in Congress. Participants in those meetings said they understand America's weariness with the war, but worry the U.S. will withdraw under circumstances that would benefit the Taliban at the Afghan people's cost. And last week, MSNBC host Joe Scarborough used his high-profile Morning Joe show to suggest that pulling out would lead to the Islamic State militants burning people in cages and the Taliban cutting off the heads of young girls. The administration hopes to craft an accord between the Taliban and Afghanistan's U.S.-backed government to prevent major clashes after the departure of American soldiers. This is a tough one, ladies and gentlemen. I've been vacillating about this nearly every other day or whenever I think about it. It's the one hand, clearly time for us to leave behind a war that was probably never winnable in the first place, although there were successes of drawing down the number of Al-Qaeda, and ISIS forces. There's still a lot of resentment among people in Afghanistan, as there were in Iraq, for example, that just didn't like foreign troops on their soil. On the other hand, you do think, it's hard not to think, about particularly Afghani women and children who will once again be at the whims of these wild Taliban men who live in the Middle Ages and just have no sense of fairness in terms of allowing women to be educated, much less you know, drive a car and have a say in government. In any event, this is an issue that's above many of our pay grades, but nevertheless, we should pay close attention to this in the coming weeks as this May 1st deadline approaches. Now, our latest American Survival newsletter is out. It features an in-depth article from Doug Nolan of the Credit Bubble Bulletin, an article called Archegos and Ponzi Finance, very informative. Plus Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs and her Food for Thought column called Plague of Profits, another a series of articles about the pandemic. My article is about the shortcomings and unintended consequences of Fed actions over the past year or so. You can subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our What of Rush of Gold and Silver blog at dgscoins.com. That's dgscoins.com. The old nursery rhyme, to market, to buy a fat pig. Home again, jiggity jig. Well, it's based on a rural America tradition of going to a market or fair to buy and sell farm goods. More recently, however, pig has also been applied as slang for someone who's seen as greedy or who's forgotten their investment strategy to focus on getting rich quick, mainly through speculative gains. But I'm suggesting a new variation on the latter theme, namely that the pig has morphed from the greedy investor into the central bankers who have bloated their balance sheets in an unprecedented attempt to guarantee that greed. In the U.S., to ward off another Great Depression, the Federal Reserve has taken control of the economy through unparalleled intervention. The Fed's actions have included manipulating stock and precious metal market prices, controlling interest rates, and propping up primarily large companies on a previously unimaginable scale. Now, the U.S. likes to think of itself as a market-run capitalist economy. But as Dion Rabuin of Axios argues, the market is seemingly now governed by an unelected and largely independent group of technocrats that directs it by creating ridiculous sums of money to buy assets. Many of those assets are government bonds used to fund our nation's debt. Now, even with this control, the Fed is, by its own admission, failed to fully reach its dual mandated goals of stable prices and maximum employment, however you define the latter. But you have to admit, the Fed probably prevented a depression by setting interest rates near zero last March and by buying so many bonds in the open market that its balance sheet has soared to $7.7 trillion as of a month ago, March 8th. That's $3.5 trillion, or 83% greater than the $4.2 trillion the Fed held just 1 year earlier, before the start of the pandemic and its QE infinity, and is 221% more than the $2.4 trillion it held at the end of 2010. Julia Coronado, who's president of Macro Policy Perspectives and a former Fed staffer, says, "Rigging the economy. That's what the Fed is there to do. Congress has given the Fed a job to do." This is her again. "It's supposed to rig the economy in a favorable way, reduce the amplitude of business cycles, reduce the severity of business cycles, and get us back to work as fast as possible." Well, investors, not to mention the jobless and underemployed, have been hoping that with the Fed's QE infinity coupled with $6 trillion in fiscal stimulus from Congress, companies would have hired a lot more workers by now. But according to Columbia University economist and Nobel Prize recipient Joseph Stiglitz, that's no longer how the economy works, how the U.S. economy works. During the new millennium, instead of hiring, companies have been buying back their stock at unprecedented rates and have been investing in artificial and related technology that's intended to replace workers, human workers, that is. Just last week, Melody and I talked about how big oil is poised to replace 200,000 jobs held by humans with robots in the U.S. alone by the end of this decade. Now, Stiglitz told Rabowin, we've been through a period where low interest rates have not stimulated the economy very much, and where disproportionately companies increase profits go into automation, killing jobs, not creating them. At a zero interest rate, he added, the cost you focus on is the cost of labor, because that's your only cost. Whereas if the cost of capital goes up relative to the cost of labor, you get a more balanced kind of innovation and investment. But Rabowin points out that many argue the Fed's astonishing intrusion in the economy is simply an attempt to make up for a new world of slowing growth, growing debt, an aging population, and a dysfunctional Congress. To battle the pandemic, the Fed announced at the end of March last year that it would buy an unlimited amount of U.S. government bonds and mortgage-backed securities. It would also purchase corporate bonds, including debt with a junk credit rating, and even providing financing directly to individual companies. Former Fed economist Vince Reinhardt asks, why does the Fed have outsized influence on financial prices? Because it's shown itself willing to act. If something really bad happens, the Fed is stepping in. Well, I guess that's a backhanded compliment to the Fed. Reinhardt added, the lunchtime bully doesn't enforce order on the school playground by beating everybody up. They just have to beat up one or two kids to have an impact. Knowing that asset prices can fall only so far, like they did last March before the Fed will act, encourages market participants to buy at any level. I mean, just look at the S&P 500 index's price-to-earnings ratio. As measured by the so-called Shiller P.E. ratio, which divides the price of the S&P 500 index by the average inflation-adjusted earnings over the past 10 years, the P.E. ratio was 36.7 as of yesterday. That means the average company in the S&P 500 is trading at about 37 times its earnings. Shiller calls that an extreme bubble. By contrast, the ratio was 43.2 at the height of the dot-com bubble at the turn of the century and was around 26 when the Great Recession began in late 2007. Over the past 10 years, the P.E. ratio has averaged close to 17.5, and here we are more than double that. Guggenheim Partners CIO Scott Minard believes Fed actions have also destroyed the ability of the market to determine a company's value. He says, and this is spot on, the definition of market prices now is whatever the Fed says it will be. Think about that for a second. The definition of market prices is whatever the Fed says it will be. Many economists say the combination of ultra-low interest rates and inflated asset prices discourage saving and encourages risk-taking, empowering a wave of speculative investments. Well, in theory anyway, although, you know, the anomaly lies in the savings, particularly the excess savings, over $1 trillion over the past year. Go figure. The effects of the speculative investments can be seen in the rise of Bitcoin and other cryptos, which supporters have hailed as a saving asset that the Fed can't manipulate. There's also frenzy in meme stocks like GameStop, and the rise of the stock market to record highs, even as the economy has had its largest contraction since the end of World War II. Fed's policies also allowed big companies to issue record amounts of debt at very low rates, which has kept many of them in business during a largely unforgiving pandemic. But as we've talked about in this program, that privilege is also extended to unprofitable zombie companies, those without enough revenue to pay off their current monthly debt obligations, and has kept new and vibrant firms from disrupting the inefficient ones. The benefits of this extreme action are supposed to reach everyday Americans, but are largely resulting in a bonanza for the wealthy. Roughly 90% of stocks are held by the top 10% of wage earners. And more than a year after the Fed launched its market onslaught, there are still 8.4 million fewer Americans employed than before the pandemic. Food insecurity has increased and poverty rates remain elevated from a historical perspective. America's billionaires, on the other hand, well, they've seen their fortunes grow by nearly $1.5 trillion. If you think it's hard to catch a squealing pig in general, ladies and gentlemen, just wait to see how hard it is to get your hands around one that's greasy. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. I'll be back on Thursday. Melody will be joined by Butch tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks a lot for listening to Financial Survival. And please, please be safe out there. Bye-bye.